mama's watching Venezuela, mama's like Cinderella, mama's got a chupa, yeah. I say hola, hola.
Hello all, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and I apologize for the time lapse between episodes. As much as I love making this show, it is a hobby, and occasionally my real-world job has to take precedence. I've been pretty good about only missing episodes when I'm on trial, and that's what happened here again. The last several weeks, I was on trial in Nassau County in a first-degree murder case. But that's over, and I'm back. We had a bit of a hiccup also as my newly married brother, who also happened to do my audio engineering, decided he was going to abandon me for the summer to go to Vienna and work at a European music festival. I know, he's selfish, but he's my brother, so I can't really say anything bad about him. Anyway, I have sourced a new talented audio engineer to make my voice velvety soft and pleasant while keeping the quality as high as you're all accustomed to. So thank you very much to Eric Stipe for bailing me out. Now, before we jump into today's episode, I do want to say that I'm kind of happy that the last episode we covered was Eugene Debs, and that's the one that's been up as the most recent. I have a couple other free speech cases, which we'll be looking at down the line, but the Debs prosecution bothers me down to the core. I was really pleased at how many people reached out to ask questions or leave me feedback about it, and was overwhelmingly positive about the episode. I only received one kind of negative comment, which was that I was too preachy from a colleague. I understand where this person is coming from. It definitely was a bit of a preachy episode, but overall, I think that free speech is such an important topic that it kind of needed to be covered in that way. I honestly expected some people to challenge me on it. In today's climate, censorship is on the rise, and the desire to prosecute wrongthink is at scary levels in some corners of American culture. So I was really touched that so many listeners reached out to voice their agreement with how I view speech, even speech you or I may profoundly disagree with, because at the end of the day, the best way to demonstrate that a point of view is wrong is to engage in a vigorous public debate about it, not simply to outlaw it. Okay, that being said, today we're going to cover a Supreme Court case that just came out in the most recent term, fresh off the presses. No, it is not Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Clinic. I have my own personal opinion on that, but it's far too enmeshed currently in the culture war for me to cover it in an objective sense. And I'm not going to do the New York gun rights case, though we may cover that in a later episode, depending on how the brand new New York regulations designed basically to reinstate the laws that were just invalidated shake out in the court system, because I have no doubts that they are going to be challenged very soon also. No, today we're going to look at a case which was handed down right when the big headline grabbers were, but which received no fanfare. It wasn't covered in the news. It didn't generate massive protests. Nobody was caught trying to assassinate a Supreme Court justice because of this decision. Now, don't get me wrong. The decisions in Dobbs and New York Pistol and Rifle Association have a huge impact on the country, and they will affect millions of lives, and people should absolutely make their voices heard peacefully about how they feel about them. But there was another decision that came down without any fanfare, that piqued my attention, and which I really feel is worth discussing. This case touches on areas of criminal law and procedure which don't get discussed frequently enough, in my opinion, but which are still extremely important. Today we're going to talk about double jeopardy. This is one of those topics which everyone knows a little bit about, but unless you're a practicing criminal law attorney, you likely don't know the full ins and outs of it. When does it apply? How can prosecutors sidestep it? And what are the court rulings which set its limits? And are they appropriate? The fact is, the reason we don't hear more about this vital aspect of criminal law is that it's been functionally eviscerated by Supreme Court ruling after Supreme Court ruling. And the case which came out just a couple weeks prior to this recording was no exception. It is the latest in a long line of cases which take a very narrow reading of one of the most integral criminal law protections that we enjoy. In July 2017, a member of the Navajo tribe traveled to visit his girlfriend in Towayoc, Colorado. The town of Towayoc is situated within the Ute Mountain Ute Tribal Reservation. He was traveling with a woman, which we will call VY. For privacy reasons, her name isn't given in the actual court opinion, so I don't see any reason to give it here either. Now, while traveling in Towayoc, VY claimed that the Navajo Native American sexually assaulted her. Now, because the incident took place on tribal land, he was charged with violating a federal regulation which had been codified through the tribal penal code. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced. 6 months after his release, he was charged in federal court by the Department of Justice for the exact same incident. He was convicted again and sentenced to a period of incarceration roughly 70 times longer than he was in the first case. He appealed on double jeopardy grounds, and his case was heard by the Supreme Court. This is Merrill Dinespe versus the United States. For those of you who enjoyed the free speech episode and an expanded amount of time spent discussing my personal philosophy on that criminal law topic, we're going to do that again, though perhaps not quite as long or in depth. But first, to understand exactly what happened to Merrill Dinespe, you need to get a brief background concerning the laws of tribal lands. And we're not going to go too far into the weeds, but this is important. In 1883, the Department of the Interior authorized what are called the Courts of Indian Offenses. These are federal courts designed to, quote, civilize the Indians, unquote, by forcing them to adopt modern standards of behavior, according to the June 1883 report, which led to their creation. The department further created the Commission of Indian Affairs to help determine the tribunal rules and to define the offenses which the courts would then punish. The Department of the Interior itself, a wing of the federal government, obviously, was in charge of staffing the prosecutor's offices and the magistrate judges. The true goal was to get the Native American tribes to stop relying on medicine men to mete out justice and to adopt a standard code of conduct. Today, most tribes have established their own judicial systems, which have replaced these particular courts. But in areas where the tribes have either refused or failed to set up their own, these courts still exist and operate. Now, the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation is one such place where the Court of Indian Offenses still operates. And the reason that this is important is because it factors into double jeopardy. Stay with me here. The Court of Indian Offenses prosecutes people for violating the Code of Federal Regulations, or the CFR. These are slightly different than federal criminal statutes. The CFR is promulgated by regulatory agencies, the DEA, the EPA, the Department of the Interior, etc. They're not passed by Congress. The section of the CFR, which dealt with the offenses related to the federal tribal courts, took the standard federal offenses and then merged some of the local tribal laws. So when VY made a complaint that Merrill Dinespe had sexually assaulted her, a complaint was sworn out by the Department of the Interior, and he was prosecuted in the Court of Indian Offenses. He was charged with assault and battery, making terroristic threats, and unlawful imprisonment, which is essentially holding someone against their will and preventing them from leaving a location. Now, initially, Dinespe claimed that the sexual contact was consensual, but ultimately he elected not to go to trial and pleaded guilty to assault and battery. Consequently, the other two charges were dismissed. The magistrate judge overseeing the case sentenced him to 140 days imprisonment, so just under 5 months, after which time he was released. And typically, this would end our discussion. A crime was committed. Defendant arrested and charged. Defendant pleads guilty. Judge imposes sentence. Defendant serves sentence. Rinse, repeat. But in this particular case, something different happens, something which deeply troubles me. 6 months after Dinesbe is released, he's arrested again. But this time he's prosecuted by the Department of Justice. A grand jury in the Federal District of Colorado charges him with one count of aggravated sexual abuse in an Indian county, which is an offense covered by the Federal Major Crimes Act. The Federal Major Crimes Act gives the federal government jurisdiction over certain crimes committed by Native Americans in Native American territory. On that list of crimes covered are rape and sexually assault. That's all you really need to know about the Major Crimes Act. So technically, under federal law, the Department of Justice, through the United States Attorney for the District of Colorado, has jurisdiction over this incident also. So here is where double jeopardy comes into place. Double jeopardy is codified in the Fifth Amendment. Chances are, if you're listening to this show, you have some passing familiarity. So here's the exact text of the Fifth. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia when in actual service in time of war or public danger. So that's the requirement of prosecution for a felony by grand jury. The next clause of the Fifth deals with double jeopardy. It says, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. The Fifth follows with the protection of being forced to testify as a criminal defendant and the mandate that nobody be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process and the no takings clause. But that's what we're here to talk about today. It's one minor clause, kind of awkwardly written, which has major implications. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb. And while the Fifth Amendment technically applied to the federal government when it was written, double jeopardy is now applicable to the states as well through the 14th Amendment. Now, the text, despite being kind of weirdly written, seems relatively simple, right? The concept is clear. A person cannot be put on trial more than once for a particular offense. The theory behind this is fairly easy to envision. We don't want our government putting a person on trial, losing, and turning around and trying them again with a new jury, perhaps one more sympathetic to the government. Without double jeopardy, the state or federal government would be able to just keep putting someone on trial until they got their conviction. So it's not difficult to see why that would be a horrible way to devise a criminal justice system. The prosecution gets one bite, one crack at making their case. They have to be thorough in gathering their evidence. They have to ensure they've got all their ducks in a row. And they have one chance to put the matter on trial to try to convict a defendant. At least that seems to be what the text says to me. But now let's complicate it a tiny bit. It says you can't put someone on trial twice for the same offense. So does that mean a prosecutor can play games with the charges to ensure they get a win? Let's take a quick example. Let's say that Andrew is arrested and charged with murder. He hires a great lawyer who goes to trial, and Andrew is acquitted of murder by a jury verdict of not guilty. So can the state rearrest Andrew and charge him with attempted murder? That's technically not the same offense, right? And if he's acquitted of that, can they rearrest him for assault, which is a whole new offense? And the answer is no, because of something called lesser included crimes. If a person is acquitted, they cannot be brought back to trial for what's referred to as a lesser included crime. And here's how you can think of that particular denomination of criminal actions. If all of the elements of one crime are contained as part of another crime, then it's a lesser included. Because in order to convict of the other crime, you have to establish all of the lesser included's requirements. So with our example of Andrew's situation, if Andrew is charged with murder initially, the prosecutor is required to show that Andrew intended to bring about the unlawful death of another person and subsequently brought about that person's death. Let's say the prosecutor claims that Andrew stabbed the person to death. Andrew is acquitted. and the state now wants to charge Andrew with attempted murder. To convict Andrew of attempted murder, the state would have to prove that Andrew intended to cause the death of another person and then did something to try and bring it about. The fact that it didn't actually cause the death isn't really important. The fact that he took some action to try is what's important. So the fact that the state charged Andrew with stabbing the person is what carries the day, not that the person survived or died from it. Because of that, if Andrew was convicted of the murder, he would necessarily also have to be convicted of the attempted murder, since there's no legal possibility of him fulfilling the elements of the murder charge without also fulfilling all the elements of the attempted murder charge. So we can say that attempted murder is a lesser included of murder. Now, in terms of double jeopardy, if one offense is a lesser included of the other, double jeopardy attaches and a person cannot be retried on it. That comes from a 1932 case called Blockberger v. United States. And some of you may be wondering to yourselves at this point, well, what if Andrew stabbed Brad, then stabbed Charlie, and then stabbed Derek? Can Andrew be tried separately three times for these three offenses? And the answer is technically yes. These are separate offenses, and they're not lesser included because they deal with different people. So the state or federal government could theoretically elect to conduct three separate trials. But there are a number of reasons why this is extremely unlikely to happen. First, it's poor trial strategy from a prosecution perspective. You want a jury to consider every conceivable bad act that Andrew did together at once. And trying these cases separately doesn't make sense that way. It's also a massive waste of time and resources to conduct virtually the same trial three times. It's also very difficult for witnesses to testify the exact same way three times, even if they're telling the truth. So a competent defense attorney will be able to confront witnesses with contradictions or variations and be able to paint them as less than credible, again, even if they're being honest. And there isn't really any benefit that I can think of either. I guess conceivably, if the prosecutor lost the first trial, they'd still be able to try again. But now the defense attorney knows which strategy will work, and rather than have to reinvent the wheel, they'll just get the ability to improve upon something that's already proven successful. So it makes sense to put someone on trial for everything you can charge them with at once. Now, with that understanding, let's tie it back into Merrill Dinesby. Before we took this tangent into double jeopardy, Dinesby had been arrested and prosecuted by the Department of the Interior Court. He had pleaded guilty to assault and battery, was sentenced to 140 days in jail, and he was released. And then roughly 6 months after being released, Dinesby is indicted by a federal grand jury in Colorado on one count of aggravated sexual abuse in an Indian county. We don't have to travel too far into the weeds again here, but it's important to note that nobody in this case is disputing that assault and battery is a lesser included of aggravated sexual abuse. And during his initial plea, Dinesby was required to give what's called an allocution. That is when the defendant is placed under oath and in his or her own words, or more commonly in a statement drafted by his or her lawyer, explains to the judge what that person did in order to be guilty of the crime. It's a brief factual recitation of the specifics of the person's conduct, which forms the basis for the plea, so the court can be satisfied that the person is pleading guilty because they are, in fact, guilty. So Dinesby has already stated under oath that he committed assault and battery against VY. Dinesby's lawyer filed a motion to dismiss the federal indictment on the grounds of double jeopardy. The district court denied Dinesby's motion and declined to dismiss the indictment. Dinesby was then convicted and sentenced to 30 years in prison. And take a moment and let that sink in. Dinesby's arrested and prosecuted. He's sentenced to roughly 5 months in jail after he pleads guilty. After he's released, he's rearrested for the exact same incident. And this time, after being convicted, he's sentenced to 360 months, 30 years. That is 72 times as long as he received in the first case for the same incident. So that should already make you wonder how these two courts could have viewed the conduct with such varying degrees of severity. And once your mind comes back to earth from processing the fact that one sentence was 72 times as long as the other, you may start to scratch your head and say, wait a minute, that first court he was charged in was set up and staffed by the Department of the Interior. That feels like the federal government. And then he was charged in federal court for the District of Colorado. That also feels like the federal government. So was DeNespe prosecuted twice in federal court for the same offense? That was the argument made by DeNespe's lawyers at the trial court level. And we know that was denied. DeNespe made the same pitch to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers the District of Colorado. They upheld his conviction and sentence and declined to extend double jeopardy protections to DeNespe. So that case goes to the Supreme Court. And here's where we get some really interesting and tortured analysis. Now look, I'm a simple criminal defense attorney. A good one, if I do say so myself, but I'm not a federal judge, much less a Supreme Court justice. I didn't graduate first of my class at Harvard and clerk for a past chief justice. Objectively, my resume is not as impressive as John Roberts, Stephen Breyer, Amy Coney Barrett, or even Brett Kavanaugh. But there are times, and it's quite rare to be fair, but there are times when I read an opinion and question whether these justices actually hear themselves when they talk. Barrett writes the opinion, and she's joined by Roberts, Thomas, Breyer, Alito, and Kavanaugh. Neil Gorsuch writes the dissent, which is largely joined by Sotomayor and Kagan. This is in and of itself a fairly interesting breakdown. Breyer is generally more aligned with Sotomayor and Kagan, while Gorsuch would typically be more likely to side with Roberts and Alito, but here we are. So you have the facts as both sides agreed them to be. Both the Barrett opinion and the Gorsuch dissent state the procedural history as it has been given to you. And the question is whether the conviction should be vacated and the case dismissed due to double jeopardy. Barrett says, in the majority opinion, that there's no question here that double jeopardy does not apply. Under double jeopardy, a person cannot be prosecuted twice for the same offense. To her, the key words here are the same offense. To the majority, DeNespe simply has not been prosecuted for the same offense. Right off the bat, Barrett states in her opening paragraph, quote, an offense defined by one sovereign is necessarily different from an offense defined by another, even when the offenses have identical elements, end quote. So double jeopardy to Barrett does not exist here. According to the majority opinion, the first case involved charges which were tribunal laws infused into the Code of Federal Regulations, or the CFR, and prosecuted in a CFR tribal court. The actual law, which was the basis for the first prosecution, then came from tribal sovereignty, and thus the offense is tied to that tribal sovereignty. The second prosecution was for a federal law under the Major Crimes Act, which attached federal penalties. That offense is tied to the sovereignty of the federal government. The concept of an offense, as contemplated by the Double Jeopardy Clause, is defined by the law which creates the prohibition or the violation. Thus, if the sovereigns involved in creating the specific laws at issue are different, Barrett concludes that the offenses must necessarily be different, even though they may apply to the exact same conduct and contain the exact same elements. Here's how Barrett herself writes it. Quote, because the sovereign source of a law is an inherent and distinctive feature of the law itself. An offense defined by one sovereign is necessarily a different offense from that of another sovereign. End quote. Dinesby had argued that dual sovereignty was not applicable here because both prosecutions and both statutes he was being prosecuted under were federal. Barrett dismisses Dinesby's sole sovereign argument by stating that the Double Jeopardy Clause does not prohibit successive prosecutions by a single sovereign if they do not involve the same offense. And here, she writes, the offenses were separate. Thus, it doesn't matter if it was successive federal prosecutions. The Double Jeopardy Clause protects against twice being prosecuted for the same offense. Barrett says it is silent as to who brings the prosecutions. Thus, there is no prohibition against the same sovereign prosecuting a defendant multiple times for the same conduct, so long as the actual offenses are different. And that's the majority opinion. It doesn't violate double jeopardy, because while the conduct or actions were the same, and the elements of the crimes are aligned, the fact that one was a tribal offense codified in the CFR and the other was a federal statute meant that there was no issue prosecuting Dinesby twice. Offenses are derived from the text of the statute, but also weighing in considerations of what sovereign it was who promulgates the violation. Now, the first few lines of Neil Gorsuch's dissent read as follows. Quote, federal prosecutors tried Merrill Dinesby twice for the same crime. First, they charged him with violating a federal regulation. Then, they charged him with violating an overlapping federal statute. Same defendant, same crime, same prosecuting authority. Yet, according to the court, the Double Jeopardy Clause has nothing to say about this case. End quote. Gorsuch thinks that the dual sovereign loophole shouldn't exist. He says that if planned correctly, the dual sovereign doctrine allows prosecutors in one jurisdiction to use prosecutions as test cases or dress rehearsals for another. As I discussed earlier, I don't necessarily think that that's all too likely to happen, but I'm following what Gorsuch is saying with regards to giving prosecutors the ability to punish a person twice for what is quite literally the same offense. And rather than using a prosecution as a dress rehearsal, I think the real danger here is the federal government stepping in and saying that the first sentence wasn't enough and re-prosecuting somebody to get a stricter sentence, which is exactly what happened to Merrill Dinesby. Not only is the federal government given an opportunity to convict someone after they've been acquitted or convicted, but it allows a prosecutor to reshape their theory or strategy. It also gives prosecutors enormous ability to pile on if they feel a sentence is too light. The Gorsuch dissent goes on to say that the court's logic does not make sense. They agree that the same sovereign cannot prosecute the same individual twice for the same criminal act. But the majority simply brushes that mandate aside by claiming that the same sovereign actually can prosecute the same individual twice so long as the prosecutions revolve around two separate sets of laws. Now, we know how the court ultimately ruled. Barrett, writing for the majority, saw no problem with sentencing Merrill Dinesby for 30 more years in federal prison. But was that the right answer? Importantly, we're going to have to define what we mean by the right answer, because there are a number of considerations here. Was it legally correct? Was it just? Was it a fair application of due process? Is the outcome ethical? Is this a rule which we would want universally applied in the criminal justice field? All of these different criteria should be taken into account when analyzing whether this was the quote-unquote right outcome for Dinesby's case. At this point, if you listen to the show just to understand the background of the case and how the outcome was justified by the court, you can tune out, because this is the part where I get a little bit preachy again. I have serious issues with this ruling. I think this is a case, and we are seeing this more and more frequently in our high court decisions, where the law is bent to a preferred outcome. That is unequivocally not the way the Supreme Court is entrusted by the American people to operate. The Supreme Court is counted on to dispassionately and apolitically review issues concerning constitutional law and determine what the law is as it applies to that particular situation. This has been the case since Marbury v. Madison, when our country was still in its infancy. Now, obviously, because judges are appointed by the president, and that's a political position, there are politics involved with selecting judges. We all get that. But for the most part, Americans are able to delude themselves into thinking that the Supreme Court justices, once they take the bench, rise up above politics, and that allows us to give the appropriate weight and validity to the decisions that they render, even if we disagree with them. But there are times when those decisions entail so much twisting, contorting, and such warping of both text and the idea behind it that the outcome becomes as shocking as it is preposterous. And to me, this is one of those occasions. The Double Jeopardy Clause, while a bit oddly phrased, conveys a clear intent. No person should be put in a position to lose their life or their freedom twice for the same offense. I know how I interpret that, and I'm guessing the majority of people would view it the same way. Once a person is prosecuted for conduct which has been charged as a crime, they cannot be subject to a subsequent prosecution for that conduct. That seems fairly clear to me. This whole idea of dual sovereigns crafting separate laws, which means that two basically identical crimes are actually different offenses because one comes from a tribal offense codified into the CFR as opposed to a federal criminal statute, it's just an absurd attempt to justify a harsher sentence because of personal feelings about law and order. The Gorsuch dissent here so cleanly and clearly states the problem with the majority opinion. When you parse through the several layers of rhetoric, what Barrett's decision actually says is that it's okay to prosecute an individual multiple times for the same conduct as long as it's for laws which were enacted by different bodies. This, to me, violates the spirit of the Double Jeopardy Clause. When I read the term offense, to me, it makes sense to tie that word to the conduct which it represents. Barrett says that DeNesby was first prosecuted for the offense of assault and battery, and then later prosecuted for the offense of aggravated sexual assault. Two separate offenses, and therefore double jeopardy doesn't trigger. Gorsuch and I agree that this is simply court-created nonsense to justify bad policy. The very idea that we would look at certain conduct and say, okay, that conduct violates this law prohibiting this type of behavior, and for that you are going to be punished by X, and then turn around after that punishment has run its course and say, by the way, now we're going to revisit that exact same conduct, charge you again, and enhance your punishment because of a different law established by Y, is just antithetical to the concept of justice and due process. I don't care if the punishment is 70 times as long as the first one or just one extra day in jail. It doesn't change the fact that it's wrong. This case was just a continuation of a poor legal doctrine that's been around for decades. This time, it was a tribal court and the federal courts, which is understandably a pretty rare occurrence. But this ruling paves the way, under the dual sovereign doctrine, for far more common applications of multiple prosecutions. There are a number of actions and behaviors which violate not only state penal laws, but also federal criminal statutes. Those two sources are enacted by different sovereigns for the purposes of double jeopardy. Under the Barrett decision, an individual previously convicted of a felony, who is now caught with the firearm, could be prosecuted by the state, as nearly every state has a law barring felons from possessing firearms. But also that person could be prosecuted by the federal government, because there is a federal statute which bars anyone with a felony record from possessing a gun. Narcotics are another prime example of how someone could potentially be charged with violating both a state and a federal law by one criminal act. If you simply read the Double Jeopardy Clause, it does not give carve-outs for laws enacted by specific sovereigns. It does not explicitly state that it only applies to the same prosecutorial body bringing the charges. It is far more open and expansive. It merely says that the same offense cannot be used to prosecute someone multiple times. The plain meaning of that text should be what we are basing our rulings on. In summation, giving Merrill Dinesby would very well could amount to a life sentence in prison for an act for which he was already charged, pleaded guilty, and served roughly 5 months in jail, strikes me as an affront to justice and due process. In my mind, and perhaps you will agree with me, if you do, let me know. I feel that this is precisely the type of situation which the Double Jeopardy Clause was written into the Fifth Amendment to prevent. It's not just that the prosecutor shouldn't be able to lose at trial and just start the process again, but it's also that once a person has been prosecuted for an action, they should be able to rest assured that it won't come back and put them in jeopardy again. It is fundamentally unfair to craft a justice system where we can design laws to prohibit conduct in such a way that if the federal government doesn't feel that a state sentence was harsh enough, they can simply rearrest the offender and prosecute him or her in federal court for the exact same thing. And the legal gymnastics required by the majority to uphold this ruling, the lengthy exposition on the origin of the various statutes, the history of the tribal courts and the CFR and how the offenses all came to be, all of that is empty rhetoric to force a round conclusion through a square rule. Justice Gorsuch was right on this one. There is no place for a dual sovereign analysis in double jeopardy thought. Let's just look at what the text clearly says and apply it. Let's uphold the oath to do justice. Let's value due process. And more importantly, in this era of American history, let's set aside our own personal opinions about law and order, about criminal defendants, about who deserves what. And let's look at what the Constitution says and just apply it. Based on his plea of guilty in the first case, I'm comfortable saying that Merrill Dinesby sexually assaulted VY. That is an abominable act, and he should be punished for it. He accepted responsibility. He was sentenced to 140 days. You may think that that wasn't enough. Maybe it was too lenient, that he got away with something. Put that aside. For our purposes, that doesn't matter. That is not what we are considering here. It wouldn't change the legal analysis if he'd been sentenced to 5 years and then after his release was rearrested and prosecuted by the Department of Justice. But now, Merrill Dinesby is going to serve his sentence. His appeals have been exhausted, and the country's legal system is worse off for it. So that's the show on Merrill Dinesby, the Double Jeopardy Clause, and Lesser Included Crimes. I hope you enjoyed it. I know there were a number of high-profile cases in the recent Supreme Court term, and I do plan on covering more of them. But again, this is not a culture war podcast. I do not get into political issues. I have no problem covering Dobbs or the New York gun case, but I think listeners wouldn't really enjoy the shows as much because they're such charged issues and I wouldn't be engaging in that side of those discussions. I feel like people might find the analysis empty without the rage and the rhetoric. But perhaps I'm wrong. I've already received a couple requests to go into Dobbs, and if more people reach out and want to get an in-depth look at the background and the Mississippi law which triggered this, what the arguments were, and what Alito's actual reasoning and analysis was about why Roe needed to be overturned, as well as the arguments in the dissent, reach out to me. And if enough people want it, we'll do it. On that note, if you do want to reach out to me, you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod. can find me on Instagram at Insummation. You can visit the show's website, insummation.com, and leave comments there, or you can look me up the old-fashioned way at my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Leave me feedback. Ask me questions. Tell me where you agree or disagree with me. Request a topic or a case to cover. You can ask, as some people have, general questions about criminal law or constitutional law that you have burning inside you. Thanks again to everyone who has reached out and who listens to the show. If this is your first time or you're new to the program, please feel free to subscribe, rate the show, and help other people find it. And please check out the rest of the catalog. As I mentioned in the intro, my brother Dan, who has been doing the audio for the show for years, has abandoned me for Europe. So a very special thank you again to Eric Stipe, who I have co-opted from another podcast, which I very much enjoy, where he works on the audio there. And I have enticed him to do the audio on this program to keep up the high standards, which you have all come to expect. So thank you, Eric. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.